The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Susan Hennessy. This is the Lawfare Podcast.
Shorts.
This afternoon, I, along with my colleagues Michaela Fogel, Quinta Jurassic, and Benjamin Wittes, published four principles for reading the Mueller report. It seems to be real this time, if perhaps a bit late for the prediction by former presidential lawyer Ty Cobb in the summer of 2017 that Robert Mueller's investigation would be over by Thanksgiving of that year. While Cobb was off by more than a year and a half, there are now clear signs that the special counsel's office really is close to concluding its work. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has set a departure date of mid-March after reports surfaced that he would leave the Justice Department only after Mueller finished the probe. As of February 20th, CNN has reported that Attorney General Bill Barr may announce as early as next week that Mueller has completed his investigation and that Barr plans to shortly thereafter send a confidential summary of the report to Congress. NBC's Pete Williams likewise announced that a report from the special counsel's office may head to the Justice Department as early as next week. And the Washington Post reported that the Justice Department is preparing for Mueller to issue a confidential report, and that Trump administration officials are concerned that the report will contain information that is, quote, politically damaging, unquote, but falls short of alleging criminal conduct. Of course, no one outside the Department of Justice knows for certain precisely when the investigation will conclude. But perhaps more importantly, no one outside the Department of Justice knows what the report will contain. No one knows whom it will vindicate. No one knows whether it will conclude that President Trump was a Russian agent, or whether it will, to quote Trump himself, quote, totally clear the president, end quote, or whether it will find that he obstructed justice or abused power, or acted wholly within his legitimate Article II powers. Nobody knows whether it will describe conduct far worse than that which has so far come to light, or whether it will debunk allegations that have unfairly haunted the president. All of which makes the present a good moment to articulate some principles for how folks should read the Mueller findings when they do emerge, because the nation still remains behind what the philosopher John Rawls described as the veil of ignorance. It is an excellent time to set some ground rules regarding how people should engage this material, regardless of their political affiliations or views of the Russia scandal. In Rawls's theory, people should craft rules for how to fairly set up a society behind the veil when they don't know what societal advantages or disadvantages they'll have under those rules when the veil is lifted. A couple of caveats at the outset. We assume here, for purposes of argument, that the Mueller report will be factually rich, that it will both lay out detailed factual findings and analyze those factual findings under applicable law. That point, we emphasize, is actually no certainty. The regulation under which Mueller is operating does not say much about what sort of report he needs to file, as several articles on Lawfare have noted. The following analysis does not apply if Mueller's report is more skeletal and does not show its work. Moreover, the following assumes that the Mueller report actually becomes available in substantial part, and that people are thus able to assess it. If the public or Congress receives only a summary of Mueller's findings, written by a different Department of Justice official, or by Attorney General William Barr, that would raise an additional set of questions about how one should read the summary. But assuming the report gives a full accounting of the conduct at issue in the investigation, and assuming we actually get to see the material at issue, the following are four principles towards reading it fairly, offered without knowing whose political views the application of those principles will help or hurt. First, in the absence of some glaring or obvious reason to reject them, people should be prepared to accept Mueller's prosecutorial judgments. Mueller and his team are not 13 angry Democrats today, and they will not be 13 corrupt Republicans tomorrow. They are professionals who have had access to the best factual record anyone is likely to see. The determination of whether to charge, or not to charge, a given person is an informed professional judgment entitled to the presumption of regularity. The indictments that the special counsel has brought to date are all cases in which other reasonable prosecutors in Mueller's shoes would have likewise pursued charges. To the extent the cases have been litigated, Mueller has prevailed. There is no indication that he has brought cases that were not substantially merited. That means if Mueller declines prosecution as it relates to other potential defendants, onlookers should presume that those decisions also reflect responsible prosecutorial judgments. Declinations in a politically sensitive matter of this type may happen for a variety of reasons. The facts may not be adequate to support a given prosecution. Particularly with respect to the president, there are major legal impediments to prosecution, both with respect to the application of specific statutes to the exercise of Article II powers, and with respect to the threshold question of whether the president is amenable to indictment while he remains in office at all. There are also prudential factors that may counsel against bringing a given case. For example, a witness who has some exposure to possible prosecution may provide essential cooperation, and prosecutors may, as a consequence, forego charges. All of these factors are legitimate, and people should be prepared to accept the legitimacy of outcomes that don't involve prosecutions. Second, people should also accept the factual record as described in the report in the absence of specific reason to doubt it. This does not mean that Mueller is some kind of deity whose word on factual matters is infallible. It is, however, a recognition that Mueller has had the benefit of an elite staff of lawyers and investigators who have had access to an array of witnesses and documents and intelligence available to nobody else. This means, quite simply, that he knows more than everyone else does, and is thus in a position to change the working factual record dramatically, whereas onlookers can only argue about the existing record, or, in the case of investigative reporters or congressional committees, inch it forward at the margins. As a consequence of this reality, if Mueller concludes, based on the evidence that he has collected, that a meeting took place, the working presumption should be that the meeting took place. If he says two individuals communicated with one another on a particular subject on a particular day, let's take that as presumptively true unless and until it is rebutted. This principle gets slightly trickier for stories that Mueller is effectively debunking. His report, after all, is very unlikely to offer conclusions in the negative. For example, the Mueller report likely will not say that Michael Cohen never traveled to Prague, but might conclude instead that the investigation had not turned up any evidence that Cohen had traveled to Prague. In such a case, it might be tempting to seize on the distinction and conclude that because Mueller didn't say that Cohen didn't travel to Prague, the possibility that he did so is still there. Resist this temptation. That way lies madness. If a matter has been thoroughly investigated and the special counsel has not found evidence to support an accusation, we should consider the matter closed unless and until new information arises to support it. The basic principle, in short, is that people should take as the factual record those facts the special counsel affirmatively finds and not supplant that record with facts that they wish he had found. Only if he specifically leaves a question open as unresolved should it be treated as unresolved. Third, and this point significantly qualifies the previous one, the report only covers what it covers. There may be many lines of inquiry the public feels are relevant to the L'Affaire Russe story, or to ethical and legal questions about the president and his family more generally, that are not within the scope of the Mueller report. The report itself will likely address a far narrower set of questions. Mueller, after all, has clear jurisdictional limits. While countless news reports have contended that he is investigating this, that, or the other, the investigation almost surely has behaved in a disciplined fashion that focuses on some things and leaves the rest for other actors. So while the Mueller report can be considered an authoritative record on those questions that it addresses, that it does not address some particular issue cannot be taken as evidence that Mueller has investigated that issue and found it without merit. Fourth, a decision not to prosecute does not necessarily resolve questions of morality, ethics, or impeachability. It might, of course. If Mueller concludes as a factual matter that there was no collusion or that there was no evidence of any sort of collusion, people should be prepared to consider not merely the criminal matter closed, but the moral matter closed as well. But conversely, if Mueller finds a series of facts and concludes that those facts either do not amount to a prosecutable crime or that some law bars bringing that case, people are free to judge those facts. Fact patterns that Mueller may choose not to prosecute or may be barred from prosecuting may nonetheless warrant the opprobrium of all decent people. They may warrant impeachment and removal from office, the standards of impeachment being quite different from the standards of criminal law. They may warrant civil liability. Consider, for example, the matter of obstruction of justice. Since the dawn of the obstruction probe, the problems of bringing a criminal case against the president have been apparent. Even without accepting the broad conception of Article II authority as William Barr advocated, there is no doubt that Article II limits to some degree the application of the obstruction statutes to the president. Moreover, indicting the president would independently violate the Justice Department's view of his temporary immunity from criminal process. So nobody should be surprised if Mueller concludes that he cannot bring a criminal case. Such a finding that no case is plausible, however, in no sense answers the question of whether the president's conduct is acceptable. That is a judgment for other actors, the body politic and the Congress, who get to take Mueller's factual findings and use them in their own assessments, which may legitimately proceed under altogether different standards. In many ways, the question of criminal prosecution is not the most important one before the public. The most important question is the president's fitness for office, both as a political matter that will be for voters once again in less than 2 years, and, in the interim, as a potential matter of impeachment. These are not questions a prosecutor should answer, nor questions which a prosecutor is even capable of answering. So while people should accept Mueller's prosecutorial judgments, they should not transform declinations into character references, or otherwise transform prosecutorial judgments into political judgments of propriety. Over the past 2 years, President Trump and some of his allies have carried out a relentless public relations campaign against the Mueller investigation, calling it, quote, a witch hunt, asserting it's run by angry Democrats and that it's totally compromised and conflicted. This campaign seems to be aimed at ensuring that there is not a political will to act on the report if it includes information that damages the president. Last year, the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, stated as much, saying that the efforts to paint the investigation as a witch hunt were, quote, for public opinion, because eventually the decision here is going to be to impeach or not impeach. Members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are going to be informed a lot by their constituents. And so our jury, as it should be, is the American people, end quote. Those who have insisted on the necessity and integrity of the investigation need to be careful of falling into a similar trap if the Mueller report is anticlimactic or does not shed significant additional light on the conduct of the president and his associates. It is the discipline of actually believing in apolitical law enforcement that if the report reveals no collusion or no evidence of collusion, opponents of the president must be prepared to accept that result and not do as the president and some of his supporters have done, impugn the integrity of the investigators. At the same time, it is critical to remember that Mueller is a prosecutor with a limited mandate. That means there are a lot of questions his report will not answer and judgments he will not render. These questions his report may well tee up, and the judgment will be left to others. The Lawfare Podcast
Shorts.
Is brought to you in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast service of your choice. Today's audio engineer for the podcast has been Michaela Fogel. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.